Welcome back to Kicking the Seat, a movie podcast from The Last Guy Anyone Asks. I am, as always, that guy, Ian Simmons, and you're listening to the audio companion to kickseat.com. It's episode 306 of This Thing of Ours, and today I'm thrilled to present a discussion of one of 2018's best films so far, John Krasinski's A Quiet Place. You've probably seen the trailers by now, in which Krasinski and real-life wife Emily Blunt star as a couple trying to keep their family together in a world overrun by aliens who are hypersensitive to sound. That means no talking, no dropping things, and no running unless the ground is covered in sand. There's a lot to talk about with this intense, intelligent thriller. Yes, it's also a bona fide horror movie. And joining me on mic are David Fowley of Keeping It Real and Lee Showquist of ChicagoFilm.com. We caught A Quiet Place at the AMC River East on Monday night, and then adjourned to the lobby bar for a wide-ranging look at the film's themes, influences, and impact as a transcendent piece of crowd-pleasing entertainment. A couple notes. Nowhere in this chat did we mention the screenwriters by name. That's a crime that I'll happily rectify here. Brian Woods and Scott Beck did a wonderful job in collaboration with Krasinski and executive producer Michael Bay. We've all given Bay a lot of crap over the years, not unduly so, but every once in a while he puts his stamp on something special, and he should be forever commended for giving Woods and Beck's little screenplay that could a chance. When you get a chance, check out the Dynamic Duo's piece in IndieWire about how the film got made. Next, deep into the episode, we speculate that A Quiet Place might unseat Ready Player One as the box office champ this weekend, and possibly carry the day until Avengers Infinity War comes out at the end of April, completely overlooking next week's release of Rampage. It's a tough call. I'm sure Rampage will make quite an impression as the pre-summer CGI spectacle it is, but I can't imagine it having A Quiet Place's word of mouth. In other words, it might eclipse Krasinski's film money-wise, but people will most likely still be talking about it weeks or months down the line. Before we get to A Quiet Place, here's a reminder that Doc 10 returns to the Davis Theater for its third blockbuster year of presenting high-quality documentaries and conversations with the people who made them. By the time you hear this, my segment on Chicago Film News with Pat McDonald about the festival should be up on YouTube. Check that out for some quick thoughts on the Elvis Legacy documentary The King and the Ruth Bader Ginsburg bio RBG. There's lots more where those came from at Chicago's Davis Theater, now through Sunday. For showtimes, tickets, and more info, visit doc10.org. And if you haven't yet contributed to the Seed and Spark campaign for Michael Glover Smith's next film, Rendezvous in Chicago, well, get on that. In just over a week, the project has nearly crossed the three-quarter mark, which is incredible, but they still need your help to make the movie a reality. This is the third film in Michael's superb trilogy about Chicago relationships, following on the heels of Cool Apocalypse and Mercury in Retrograde, two absolutely essential works to watch for anyone wondering just how far a creator can push an indie budget and make a film feel like a Sundance darling, minus the pretentiousness that implies. If you want to learn more about Rendezvous in Chicago, listen to the intro to last week's Ready Player One episode, in which I interviewed Michael and producer Lane Marie Williams. Then become a contributor at seedandspark.com/fund/rendezvous-in-chicago, or just click the banner at kickseat.com. Okay, I'll shut up now. Time to go to my quiet place with David and Lee, in which we make a lot of noise about a movie we genuinely love. Remember to follow me on Twitter and Instagram, I'm at kickseat. You can also like the Kicking the Seat Facebook fan page, and subscribe to this very podcast on iTunes and Stitcher. I also invite you to share this episode, leave a comment, and if you're so inclined, drop me a line at kickseat@gmail.com. And until next time, whenever that is, whatever that is, thanks very much for listening to the Kicking the Seat podcast, and take care.
PG-13?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, there's really no gore. And there's no foul language.
No, that's true. But it's
intense.
It's R-rated in the and the level of trauma I think people are going to experience.
Triple X in the trauma area.
Wow. Yeah, I was telling Lee, I don't know that I almost don't feel ready to talk about this movie because I'm so frazzled by it. I wasn't quite ready for it.
They should show this in every school.
There you go. Just a picture of John Krasinski with his finger up at the library.
Remember those posters that said "read"?
Yes.
Like celebrities, and he'd be like holding a book, read.
All right.
To his mouth.
Let's see. Can you scoot a little bit over? Is that cool? I don't want to make anyone uncomfortable.
No, we took a plane to Europe together for many hours, so we are like.
Oh, that's right. Sharing mics.
Those aren't pillows.
I'm on the tail end of a cold, so I'm...
Me too, hey.
Almost out of it.
High five, wait, no.
I'm on the 10-day cold. I'm on the, like, you know...
You.
When you saw me 2 weeks ago, I was on the cold. I'm
sorry. Your punishment must be more severe.
Oh, man. Bust out your vein. Your vein.
Virtual
wait,
relationships
vein?
Are really better these days. Than,
all right, so...
Yeah.
Welcome. What? Oh, are we going to have the entire...
On the set, yeah, I guess.
The entire episode is going to be... The ball game in the back on the bar TV.
Right.
Silence is golden, and so are the showers that I was peeing myself this entire movie. Wow.
I feel bad for the people who sat in front of you.
I was in front of you.
That explains. Might want to stamp off your feet on the carpet. A Quiet Place.
It sounds so serene, right? Like a nice family movie, A Quiet Place.
It does.
It's like, you know, like an update of Laura Ingalls.
It was a nice family movie.
It was, you know, I was surprised. It was a really nice movie about family. I think, well, I mean, not so nice, right?
It was a movie about a nice family.
Yeah. But with problematic, you know, preteen characters causing trouble, as they are wont to do.
A different context, right?
Yeah.
The world is a very tough place to raise teenagers.
Mm. It is, and it's even tougher when there are giant monsters rampaging around. You know, when I first... the trailers, I think, did a really good job for a change of not giving everything away.
The first trailer.
Was there a more recent one?
I've heard rumor that there's a recent one that gives way too much away.
Which you shouldn't watch, yeah.
Which you shouldn't watch. But this... The first trailer, when it showed that walk across the bridge... And then, which is basically the beginning of this movie.
Yes.
And I felt, as I watched this movie, I'm like, okay, I remember that trailer scene being intense. And it's rare that you see a trailer where a scene in a trailer is pretty intense.
Yeah.
But there's another scene in that trailer that's more intense that I thought was a little bit of a giveaway, and that was
the scene
with the bathtub.
Yeah.
And so I guess it's clever in the trailer because you're waiting for that moment to come up in the film.
Yeah.
And it plays out in the movie a little bit differently than, you, of course, you see in the trailer, in the short trailer.
Context is everything in this
movie. Right.
Well, I mean, the bathtub scene is one of those moments. First of all, that's... In describing the movie, the trailer to my wife, that's where she said, "I'm never watching that movie." she's a mother of two and gave birth last year, so anything having to do with like childbirth
and horror.
All you had to
tell her was natural childbirth, like in the movie, then she would have said no.
The right? ultimate, so. Yeah, right. I needed drugs after this. Oh well. That scene in the trailer is beautifully done because you wonder. All right, she's pregnant, that's clear. She's having to give birth in a bathtub while there's this creature that apparently is triggered by sound, and we all know the babies, when they come out, make a lot of noise. How is this going to get resolved? And it gets resolved in a wonderful way in the film. We don't need to spoil it right now. I think we'll talk spoilers in a few minutes.
Sure.
That was one of those moments where usually you watch a trailer and you're just ticking off the minutes in the movie until you get to that part, and it's... rarely as satisfying as what you had built up in your mind, and this the resolution of this particular scene I thought was fantastic. The entire movie, I hate to say, use that cliche, I was on the edge of my seat, but I was squirming. David was sitting next to me. Yeah,
I was like clawing at the air.
Yeah. I was clawing at my face. I probably gave myself like wrinkles just like tearing my skin.
I was grabbing my foot.
Yeah, restless leg syndrome people, they should not go see this movie in a theater.
You know what the thing was? I was acutely aware of every sound in the theater, though,
like you normally wouldn't be. Like right from the beginning.
So even if someone just leaned down to, pick up some popcorn or whatever it was, you could just hear it, like
at the candy wrappers.
Level, right?
Exactly. As I was watching the opening of the movie, which again is on this bridge, basically, I felt like, man, I wish every movie was called A Quiet Place. Can you imagine that? A Quiet Place, Star Wars. A Quiet Place, whatever. You know, because then, like, you're forced, the audience is forced to lean in a little closer, listen, you know, I mean...
Yeah, I was kind of concerned at the beginning that the volume might not be loud enough. We feel like it's not loud enough in a movie like this because the sound is so important and the design of the sound to pull you into it.
And the sound is great.
It was terrific, and thankfully it was up loud enough.
Yeah,
but it's so dependent on that, on the sound effects and the sound design, right?
Yeah, and it's also, I think, the suspense of knowing when the sound is going to come in because, as David said, you know, you're forced to pay attention in this movie, and you almost don't want there to be any sound because you know that means trouble. So every little, they kind of explain the rules of how these monsters work throughout the film. So you don't know if any sound can trigger this thing. So you're walking on leaves. I mean, they have sand paths drawn out from the center of town all the way back to their kind of country house. Where do they get all that sand? I don't
know. Well, you know, you make trips into town, you grab sandbags, and, you know.
I guess. You walk barefoot all the way,
you know,
too,
you
right?
You make a breadcrumb trail out of sand.
Aside from the ravenous xenomorph / artichoke monsters, I think it sounds like paradise to me.
You know, it's funny because as I was watching this, I'm like, you know what? A world with no sound would be kind of great. I mean, you got your headphones.
Yeah.
As long as you have electricity, you can power your iPod, you can listen to music still. Nobody's making podcasts anymore, probably.
No cell phone conversations. You'd have to never hear anybody on the phone again, right?
That would be great. No alarms. No sirens.
Would people go back to long-form texting?
What's long-form texting?
Like, instead of LOL, you know, laugh out loud.
Laugh out loud.
Because now you've got nothing but time to form these wonderful text messages.
And maybe, you know, some people might be dying from sneezing, you know?
Yeah, nobody sneezes. Nobody, right?
They'd be like,
it took a little while to figure out the rules of the movie in a way. Like, so what sounds are not, like, acceptable versus which ones are?
Yeah.
And
right?
I love that.
Yeah,
love
and
that.
So then you get to this point in the middle of it where you're, like, not knowing exactly what, like, is fair game or what isn't, and they start to talk under the waterfall, right? And then you realize, mm-hmm. okay,
oh,
this
so
can work,
great.
Right?
Yeah.
So great.
Yeah.
And it makes so much sense. You know, a lot of little sounds don't affect them, but a big, loud, jarring sound will attract them, you know?
We're tiptoeing into spoilers.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So I think this is as good a place as any to just kind of like do a round table. Do you recommend going to see A Quiet Place?
It depends who I'm recommending it to, but
okay.
Hell yes.
Yes. Me too. I mean, this is... It's strange to say this about a John Krasinski horror movie because I don't get the feeling watching this that, you know, this is a first-time director and, you know, hey, he's got room to grow. I mean, this is a hell of a horror movie.
Yeah, it's pretty interesting that we all know sort of, I guess, if we're horror film genre fans, the allusions that he uses in the movie. There are other movies. We could probably name some of them off the top of our heads if we want. There's some things in there that you can see it's not a lift, but it's an homage to Aliens, for example.
Sure. Yeah. And Night of the Living Dead, the whole basement
Dead,
thing. I mean,
right.
But
he's done his homework.
Right.
I mean, he definitely knows what he's doing in the style of the movie and the, like we said earlier, the sound design, the editing, the cinematography, the music by Marco Beltrami as well. I mean, it's just perfectly stylish.
And he's leaning more towards like De Palma, Polanski, Hitchcock, you know, more so than say like a Carpenter or Ridley Scott or something. I mean, it's more all about the intensity of the situation. Yes, there's horror. Yes, there's monsters. Yes, you know, kids need to listen to their parents. But it's just all about the attention, and that's what's so great. I mean, obviously, it all goes back to this less is more approach. This is what you don't see is more frightening than what you do see.
Mm-hmm.
But damn, when you do see it in this movie.
And, you know, there is something to be said for that. I mean, okay, spoiler alert, who cares? I think we're all kind of in agreement to go see A Quiet, Quiet Place.
Yeah.
But, you know, when we do finally get to see the monster, I mean, it is kind of an amalgam of other things. I mean, there's some Resident Evil creatures in there. There's the Xenomorph. You know, I think even the creature from Jeepers Creepers, there's a little bit of that in there.
I thought of that too, Pumpkinhead.
Yeah.
I thought of even some of the Demigorgons from Strange Things.
Right. But the fact that this is a creature that, you know, it's a blind monster, which we've seen a thousand times before, but watching the weird organic tectonic plates shift on its head, and you see the,
so
you know,
cool.
the
yeah, it reminded me of Mimic. Remember?
Yeah, totally, yep. Totally.
But it's completely armored. I mean, these things are, they come to Earth, and I don't know that there's a lot of them, because it seems like only a few can inflict a lot of damage, but I guess they crash land on the planet, and the military can't take them down, and pretty soon they pretty much wiped out most of humanity.
Yeah.
So they're tough SOBs, but they are, you know, interesting to look at. They've got some really great, you know, weaknesses that also have to do with sound, but it's the kind of thing where it's such a random deal, like the aliens in War of the Worlds, they get undone by the flu. It's like the thing that no one would ever think to try out, you know, it works in this case.
What I liked about it is it didn't feel CGI. It felt like there's little guys in suits,
yeah,
which is so great. It's so needed.
Yeah, it felt a bit CGI to me in that last scene where we really get to see it open up and see how it works.
Okay.
But those
are close-ups, though.
Yeah, I know. The actual movements of the monsters, when you see them off in the corner and everything, it felt really nice, which is why I don't know how you fix this problem. But, yeah, I liked the idea of that last shot where it's kind of opening up and everything. But the CGI itself felt a little bit 2000 to me.
I think I know what you mean. And the thing, I think the way you fix it is only to keep it out of sight, as they do for most of the movie.
Right.
And so I think that was the intriguing piece of it, was when are we actually going to see this thing in full? And I think about halfway through the film, we start to really get a sense of what it looks like.
Yeah.
Right?
And it's still very much in shadow. Most of this movie, the parts where the creatures are coming out, they come out at night. And you don't get the feeling they're trying to hide anything. It's the most effective use of the monster. There's things popping up in cornfields and chasing you, and just the idea of this thing is terrifying enough that you don't need to go full bore and all of a sudden, oh my gosh, there's 50 of them. They have a siege on top of the barn, the roof of the barn. They gotta pick them all off with shotguns.
Right.
That's the final scene of the movie, which, frankly, that kind of Ellen Ripley moment that Emily Blunt has, I thought was like, That was the deflating balloon to me. I'm like, that shot, I don't know.
With the water between them, or?
No, the very last shot where they figure it out, and then the monsters are all coming, and then she does the clicks the shotgun, and then it cuts to black.
Yes,
I was like, you know what? I don't know. I'm not saying they need to go full mist on this movie and kill everybody off.
Yes.
But I definitely got that feeling. Like, if there's a few of these things in the area, they're going to come down to this very enclosed basement space, and it takes time to reload a shotgun.
Yeah.
I don't know if they're getting out of there. It seemed a little, not hopeful, but it just seemed a little bit more action movie than I think everything leading up to that moment felt.
A little more of a goose for us to feel like a little bit of up, right? At the end,
yeah.
Right?
Yes,
at the end
yeah.
at that point, when she's cocking the shotgun, it actually feels like a sigh of relief. Mm-hmm. Like, I know what to do now. And who knows what's going to happen.
And,
I can see what you're saying, but who knows what's going to happen. But it does feel like, okay, we have an idea what we can do.
Yeah.
You know?
There's an interesting thing that we're talking around here thematically that we should probably bring up. So we're talking about pleasing the audience in a way with that thing at the end. And this is a movie that I think horror, sometimes people think of it two different ways. There's the highbrow horror that, you know, people say we should love, and that's movies like The Witch, The Babadook, and we do. I mean,
movies that people are even uncomfortable calling horror in a
lot
of cases.
That's right. Yeah. And then there's the horror films that are the traditional crowd pleasers that goose you every 5 minutes with a jump, right? And this movie does both of those things.
Yeah.
So it has those kind of lofty intentions to be arty and smart and stylish, but it also wants to have things jump out at you. Do you know what I mean? So
yeah,
it gives you
totally
both of those things.
But it takes the cat jumping out of the closet moments seriously, and half of it is the performances, I think, at least, because there's that scene you alluded to with the nail. They call it out, which is beautiful. There's a close-up on this nail on a stair, and, you know, something bad's going to happen. I'm pretty sure I know at what moment it's going to happen.
Yeah.
Emily Blunt steps on the nail as she is about to give birth.
Her water's broken.
Everybody is away from the house. She's unable to do to get any kind of help. She steps on this nail. A moment later, she... Did the creature, she realized the creature was coming, was that the second thing she, or the third thing? It happened in threes.
She didn't know that
she didn't know. Yeah.
She didn't know. So she was walking around down there after stepping on that. And then she looked up the stairs and she saw the creature's leg. And then she was trying
to saw the creature come into the house. So, but there was that trifecta moment, like once she realized it was in the house, there's this horror reaction shot on her face that was half oh my God, and half like, you're kidding me.
Yeah.
She's so good.
She's really great.
And that's, you know, even though we know this moment is coming where she's going to step on the nail, when it happens, she's not... It's not a cartoon performance. Mm-mm. She plays it completely real. Everything, including that birth scene, I felt like I was going to pass out like three separate times because I was feeling that dizziness, that nausea, the things that you don't really see actors sell all the time in those moments of intensity.
Yeah, because it's the kind of primal emotions of survival in the movie, right? Yeah. So exclusive of the fact that there are creatures there in the house, I mean, it really is what she's got on her plate in that moment is having that child, right? I mean, she's in labor. She's by herself.
Yeah.
She's without any sort of means or medications, of course, or anything like that. So, I mean, even without those creatures, it would be a pretty terrifying situation,
right?
Yeah,
totally. I mean, even if we didn't have the creatures, if we didn't have the whole sound thing, if this was a zombie apocalypse or whatever, it was still, she was alone and she was about to deliver a baby. That's crazy.
Yeah.
Yeah. Let me ask you guys about the performances across the board in a way. I was sort of aware as I was watching the movie that there's a high level of emotional intensity through the whole thing. Now, how could there sort of not be given the situation?
Sure.
I mean, in any given scene, the stakes are so high that somebody could be killed at any moment. But I started thinking almost two-thirds of the way through the movie that there was a lot of emotion in the performances and a lot of crying, and this crying on behalf of all four of the leads multiple times in the movie. And I almost felt, for me, it was a little too much of an emotional giveaway in some of those scenes. And sometimes I think actors today love to cry. Men do, women do, kids do, and there's a lot of it.
Yeah.
And so if you look back maybe 25 or 30 years ago, you would see a lot less crying in the movies, especially on behalf of men. But I think everybody wants to go there now, and I think in this movie they really go there. And I know the situation warrants it, but I was aware there was a lot of high theatrics crying in the performances. Did anybody else, did you guys feel that way, or did you just feel like, hey, that's the moment, that's what's happening, and it's...
You know, it's interesting. I don't think anything... in a particular scene bothered me. Cumulatively stepping back, I think it was a bit much. And you're talking about archetypes from, you know, a couple decades ago. That's one thing that really stuck out to me, and not necessarily in a positive way, but okay, John Krasinski and Emily Blunt, they're a married couple who are surviving this apocalypse. They begin the movie with three little kids. After the first scene, they have two little kids.
Let's say most of the movie they have two.
Later on, they have, you know, there's a baby on the way, which we kind of talked about.
We need to talk about that later, though. Go ahead.
Yeah. But, you know, just in terms of the roles, you know, John Krasinski is, he's not your typical kind of horror movie action survivor man.
Right.
He is much more sensitive. It's very clear that this is Emily Blunt's sort of movie and very much showcasing the invincibility of women, which I think this is one of the better showcases of that without being... you know, kind of like all roar girl power, which, you know, is fine. but this is more a matter of showing and not telling.
Yeah.
But when it comes to, you know, the men or the boys in this movie, like the little boy is very timid and he doesn't want to go out and learn how to survive. The little girl does. It was almost like they're really trying to go out of their way to not have a masculine archetype in this movie. Or at least define a masculine archetype that goes against masculine
it's
archetypes.
It's not the alpha male who's going to go out and kill the, you know what I mean, who's going to slay the beast or whatever.
Right, and it seemed, not that there was an imbalance, it was just, it stuck out to me. And I don't know, I was kind of rationalizing as I went the whole idea of why the little boy needed to go out. There was almost like this moment where... it could be read as John Krasinski, as the dad, was telling his daughter, Reagan, played by the fantastic Millicent Simmons, you know, you can't come out and learn how to, you know, fish and forage and survive with me. You can't. And there's almost, I feel like it was on the precipice of him saying, you can't come because you're a girl. I got to take the boy out, become a man, that kind of thing.
I don't think it's just that. I think it's the fact that she's deaf.
Yeah.
And there's a... there's a natural tendency to want to, as a parent, to want to protect that, especially in this atmosphere where she's not going to know when she's making a noise. She's not going to know you know, because she doesn't live in a world of sound.
Yeah.
So, and he's always trying to tinker with the hearing aids to make them amplified a little bit more. Always.
And that's there's a lovely payoff at the end of that, too.
And I think, though, that there's a reason. It's not just like, I'm going to teach this boy to be a man. And I'll get to the crying in a moment. There's a reason. I mean, I think that there it's, and it may not be a justifiable reason. You know, he's not necessarily writing her off, and I don't think it's that he blames her, even though she feels that he blames her for the loss of their younger child. But I think it's really because, you know, the fact that she's deaf, he's trying to protect her.
Yeah.
And, you know, maybe he should be focused on preparing her and all that. But to answer your question, Lee, I think since the crying game, no.
But 1992.
Yeah. But no, I think really if we didn't have that opening scene, I'd be on board with you. But I think what this movie is doing after that opening scene, the shocking scene where the youngest child basically gets taken away, what I love about this movie is the rest of the movie, everybody's still dealing with this post-traumatic stress disorder of seeing a loved one just taken away and gone. And you always think, maybe I should have done this. Maybe I should have held that boy. Maybe I should have not given him the toy. Whatever. There's always a what if. And I think that in your quietest moments, there is just this release of, like, crying. And it's not a, unfortunately, in the situation of this scenario, this world building, is you can't freaking cry with sound. Yeah. So it's what I think. If sound wasn't an issue in this movie, I'd kind of be on board with you know, I don't know if it's necessarily a gripe on your end or whatever, but because sound is an issue, I think the emotion of it is amplified even more because they can't cry out loud and they're just covering their mouth or they're just trying to hold it in. And I don't think it's too much. I don't think it's...
I think it's a fair point, Dave, but I read it a little differently than you did. I mean, you're saying they're trying to hold it in. I didn't see anybody trying to hold it in, and I would have loved the subtext of the actor acting as if they were trying to hold it in and then letting it out. I think that they're letting it out a lot. And, you know, it's not necessarily a gripe, because I loved all four of the actors, and I thought the performances were really good, and I was moved by the drama of the family dynamics in the story, but I think it's just a contemporary thing that actors like to cry, and they like to cry a lot. And it's in this movie.
I will say there is one John Krasinski's final scene, where, again, turn back if you haven't watched the movie. I was very conscious of the fact that this was a Michael Bay-produced movie, and the last collaboration that they did together was 13 Hours, and there was a scene in that movie where John Krasinski screams, like, in this, you know, this kind of cathartic rage scream, and he does it again in this movie. Yeah. And it wasn't that it was funny, it's just, I don't know if he's the yelling catharsis guy.
Right.
I think everything else really hit a positive, like, a genuine note, but that moment, like, it's like, the yelling, he could have just done a cuckoo sound or something and call it over.
The quietest Michael Bay movie probably ever made,
exactly.
Right?
And thankfully, he's not like on his knees looking up at the sky, you know, crying. You know. It's warranted. The emotions are there and it's warranted. There's a reason for what he's doing. It makes sense.
Yeah.
There's a reason to, you know, what he's communicating to his children right before he lets go and makes this audible yell.
I gotta say, as far as the moments go, it was a really nice one, but as far as performance, I gotta give it to Adam Scott and Krampus. That was the exact same climax with the dad sacrificing himself in the snow. Hey, going back to that Michael Bay thing for a second, talking about influences, the one thing that really got on my nerves right off the bat was the font for this movie, A Quiet Place. When you see in the opening titles, it's the same font and treatment as the Texas Chainsaw Massacre remake. Same kind of like weathered, you know. But as far as like the suppressing the emotions, yeah, there is a lot of crying in this movie, but I think it comes out comparatively in drips and drabs, because it's about a year after this incident.
Yeah.
Normally, you get to talk things out in therapy or have long conversations or scream or cry, yeah, but they really have to keep things in to survive, so it's a constant adrenal state.
Yeah.
If you want to get all hoity-toity about it, it could be a hoity-toityan? Was it like Freudian, highfalutin Freud?
It worked.
You could say that, you know, this is a metaphor for what technology has done to us. We don't really talk much anymore. It's all, you know, communication through text or, you know, shortcuts or, like, videos and, you know, that kind of thing.
It's like the opposite of Ready Player One.
It is. Right. This, oh, man. Yeah. Double feature.
Opposite,
yes.
Right? Hey, let's talk a little bit about some of the sequence building that happens in the movies, this movie, because I think there are four or six suspenseful sequences that are really built that just continue to build and build. And my favorite one has to be the one in the grain silo,
yes,
the corn silo. Mm. And, you know, I don't know if those who are listening will know that they built an entire farm for this movie. Actually, they even created roads that didn't exist so they could make this sort of picturesque farm that we see in the movie. They planted 24 acres of corn there, and they built a 70-foot silo to create this incredible sequence in where the kids are sinking in the corn, and they put them on these platforms as well to pull them down in so they wouldn't really be in danger. So it was kind of like a game. But when you see it in the movie, I mean, it is at the climax of the film, and it the idea of it, and I don't think I've seen this in a movie before. I thought about Witness for a minute. You remember the end of Peter Weir's Witness,
totally.
Where they're both in there, and they're trying to stay on the top of the corn,
sure,
by holding onto that door, and that creature, of course, is in there with them. And I
in
thought,
Witness? No, sorry.
Yeah.
Danny Glover.
So I really just thought that particular sequence was fascinating and fun to watch, and the idea of the kind of hand going down in the corn, and, you know, people who are listening will know when they see it, but shot for shot, it was really elegantly done, and that's just one of several sequences he built that I thought were really good.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know if I could say it was fun to watch. I was, you know...
In retrospect.
Well, here's the thing. They established right off the bat that they're okay with killing kids in this movie. So by the time you get to that sequence, there's party that realizes they're not going to kill off the daughter. But when she goes down underneath that corn and she doesn't come out, I mean, I thought two things were going to happen. Three things. One, he's going to reach down, pull her up, she's going to be fine.
Yeah.
Two, he reaches down, pulls her up, she's dead.
Yes, right.
Because after ingesting all that corn and the dust.
Yeah.
Three, she reaches down and pulls up a monster.
Yeah.
There's
that.
But yeah, I agree.
Scenes.
Yes. Well, here's the thing. There, as you mentioned, there are these big set pieces, very suspenseful. And if you're describing this movie to someone, it kind of feels like an episode of 24. Like, how does all of that stuff happen to one person in the course of 24
right,
hours?
Right.
But damn it, every one of them works.
Yeah.
You do get. I felt a little bit of situation fatigue. It's like, okay, they finally made it to the to the underground bunker with the soundproof room for the baby and the little box. And then all of a sudden, there's this random pipe that's bursting. Like,
right?
Yes.
Yes.
Like, it was almost like, where is this water? Was that even a thing? And it's like, oh, no, there's just a pipe over here that's busted.
And then if the pipe's not bad enough, then there's a creature that goes under the water.
Oh, my gosh.
Yes.
And just the way it went down under the water.
It just reminded me of James Cameron's Aliens.
Yes.
Yeah, remember that?
Yeah,
it's so clearly
yeah.
like an allusion to that, and it worked
totally.
Just as well.
And the red the red scene with the bulbs and all that stuff.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. And what I like about it is that, okay, yes, it's cool that, you know, they have this environment, this farm environment. We didn't have to have everything explained to us.
Was that even their house?
Yeah,
I mean, I wondered
get the idea
about
it was
that.
Because I think that as she went back up to that room where her son was, her son had that room, that baby room.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that there were some pictures of the family on the wall.
That was the one detail that made me think that this really probably was their house, is the pictures hang up on the wall.
Yeah.
I'm thinking, are they going to really hammer the pictures in? But there was part of me watching this that felt this could be just like a found place that they just they sought shelter in and built their own. You're probably right.
Yeah.
It was their house.
But even that whole thing that you were saying about with like the whole at night, the whole place is like lit with these like clear bulbs. But we didn't have to be explained to that when there's danger, you flip the switch and it turns red bulbs. That's what I love about Krasinski is he's trusting his audience and the writers are trusting what we're seeing. But yeah, going back to that silo sequence, what's so great is just. That's a great example of the sound design in this movie, of that part where we just see or we hear the door at the top just go
it sounded like a horse. It sounded like a score. Mm-hmm. It sounded like a bit of music in there.
And you know, it did remind me of the T-Rex sequence from Jurassic Park. You got two kids in peril.
I thought that same thing, because it comes right down on the door.
Right.
That's exactly what I thought.
And you know what? Damn, you know, if we're... Now, this isn't Krasinski's first movie. Now, he's directed a couple other things. He's directed an episode of The Office, but this is his first genre picture.
Mm-hmm.
And to, like, remind us of somebody like Spielberg, I mean, that's just... It's... You could tell that, obviously, he was having... He had these directors in mind.
Yeah.
And... You know, again, is this showing us anything, like, really unique or, you know, different? Maybe not, but it's the way that this movie does what it does that stands out from really anything else.
Well, that's the thing is, like, this would be a great first horror movie I could recommend to, you know, like a teen kid. In a lot of cases, you look at modern horror and you say, this is, go watch the stuff that influenced this movie. It was done a lot better. This is a film where I could say, this is done very well. It's there are references, but you might not recognize them, even if you've seen a bunch of other movies.
Yeah.
And I could probably rattle off a bunch of those films to a young cinephile, young horror fan, mm-hmm. and say, if you love this, go back and check these out. Not like, you got to go see these because this is a better version of what you just saw.
Right.
Now, you got to talk about this, the chemistry, I think, of the two leads, because John Krasinski and Emily Blunt are married in real life.
That's right.
And...
The two kids.
Yeah, and I think that's really important to the story, because I didn't necessarily buy them as these characters, the Abbotts, because we don't know their names until you see them in the end credits. No one calls anybody.
No.
It's like, you know, your father, or go find her and that kind of a thing. But it's that chemistry to the point where halfway through the film, I felt like I was watching John Krasinski and Emily Blunt realistically survive the apocalypse
with these
two kids who might as well just be their kids.
I hope it doesn't doom them in some way. There's a long history of people who work together never, ever having anything to do with each other. Again, like
Angelina Jolie
and Brad Pitt, Burton Taylor. Yeah. I mean, there's a whole, you know, wasn't Aronofsky and Jennifer Lawrence last year? So knock on wood, hopefully this doesn't happen because, you know, this movie will be a hit, but...
Yeah, I really hope so. I mean, I think it's really weird that it's coming out the week after Ready Player One, because I have to say bye-bye Ready Player One, because this movie's going to be number one opening weekend.
If
people are already gravitating, I mean, they've already seen the trailer, they're already going to gravitate. Usually, a new horror film is number one that weekend, and then it drops big time. But this one is going to pick up.
Yeah, I feel. I mean, I don't know how these things are going to work, but I feel like this is it's a PG-13 horror movie without any of the baggage or the nonsense that usually implies. It's a film coming out that, I mean, people have seen Ready Player One. I think the ones who are really going to see it and care about it have already seen it. This is the perfect opportunity for a small movie to come out, make a big splash, and probably be a holdover until Avengers Infinity War a couple of weeks from now.
I mean, do you think the people that might have been disappointed in It Comes at Night last year would be more, like, receptive to something like this? Or?
Yeah, I mean, there are similarities definitely between this movie, but I think they're really fantastic companion pieces, like different ways of handling essentially the same kind of material.
Yeah, for me, this one was more effective, and I don't know whether it's because the concept is higher and it's more clever in terms of the way it's executed, or I like the threat I thought was more interesting in this movie. And the other one I felt was a little more routine, but there's definitely strong similarities. I felt this one was a little more of an out-and-out horror film.
Oh, definitely,
as well, right?
And that was one of the big knocks against It Comes at Night. It's like, it's not, like...
Yeah, what is it?
Right? Yeah, it was kind of like Catfish. Right, a few years ago, like, it's billed as this big horror movie. It's like, really? It's
about an only woman in Pasadena who tricks somebody into it, right?
It's a straight-up dystopian horror type thing, you know?
Yeah.
You know, but yeah, this one just, it just seems like it's going to be hitting all the right notes for people. And I think it's going to surprise people in ways that maybe they're not used to.
Yeah, and it's a great audience horror movie. I mean, there are a couple of moments of, you know, I'll use that word again, catharsis, where the audience laughed, or, you know, you can hear people kind of shrieking.
Yeah, right.
But it held everyone's attention.
Yeah.
You know, you didn't hear people say, get off your phone, or, you know, people like restlessness in a bad way. It was all like a shared communal tension, which is kind of beautiful.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting. I looked at my watch the first time that somebody said something out loud in the film, and it was about 42 minutes into the film that we have the first spoken line of dialogue,
it's
which
the
is
halfway
the scene behind the waterfall.
Is that the waterfall?
Yeah.
Yeah, it's the
first time, and I sort of couldn't believe it because
That's
the
great.
Film had sustained its pacing and its story, and everything was moving along like at such a breakneck sort of pace that, you know,
to
not hear any dialogue for almost 45 minutes of a movie, it just doesn't happen.
And it's one of those kind of films where I would have been totally on board if no one had said anything. I feel like it's one of those movies that you really would buy, hey, they're just not going to have people speak at all. That's just going to be the world we live in now.
Now, one of my only problems with the movie, and I wish it was addressed a little bit more, maybe just a conversation or something, but, man, in this world, you know, just like in a zombie apocalypse, you shouldn't bring a baby into this world. So I just felt like even having a conversation, I know that a lot of it has to do with like maybe guilt and let's start new and let's you know, maybe make up for what happened. I just feel like, okay, why'd you do that?
Well, and this gets back to something you were talking about earlier, which is the crying and the not being able to let things out.
Mm-hmm.
Because when we first find out, if you haven't seen the trailer, in the movie you find out she's pregnant.
Yeah.
And you're like, that's. I think that was the first thing that crossed my mind. It's like, what are you doing?
Yeah, why are you
But after she gives birth, I think it was right after or right before. Yeah, it was after. She and Krasinski are talking in the basement about how she had this guilt about, on the bridge, not carrying their son. And she's like, I had my backpack, and I could have been carrying him. I had my hands free. She never got over that.
Yeah.
And they might not have ever really talked about that. And so unconsciously, subconsciously, they are trying to replace their kid. They're trying to right or wrong.
Like
maybe
we can,
maybe we can get it right this time. Maybe it's some kind of a tribute to the son that they couldn't save. And it's really kind of messed up. I don't want to question anybody's motives, but if you were to sit there, if they had gone to couples therapy after the traumatic loss of their child, and they're like, yeah, we're going to try again. Any good doctor worth their salt might have been like, let's step back and take a look at what is actually going on here.
Yeah.
But they didn't have those resources. They barely had each other in that capacity.
Yeah.
I wonder if he ever took her to the waterfall. That seemed like something.
Yeah.
Was that like his man cave? Like
maybe that's on that must be on the cutting room floor or something. It would have been a good scene though.
Yeah.
I thought that scene, Ian, that you just referenced was the kind of for me the one false note in the movie where they have the discussion in the basement about I could have held on to him. I had my arms free. I think it's clear up to that point in the movie that there's a tremendous sense of guilt over what's happened to the child. There's a scene where she looks at the bed and she sort of understands that it's an empty bed, and you can really sort of tell the toll that it's taken on the family. And I thought the articulation of that was a little too on the nose. I feel guilty. I should have done something to stop this. I think we understand at that point in the movie what has happened emotionally, and the saying of it felt a little too flat.
I think the way that she said it was what kept it from being, for me, not trite, or made it necessary. The fact that she went back and replayed that moment, that scene on the bridge, a million times since that incident.
Yeah,
you can tell.
Yeah.
What she came back with was, I didn't have anything in my hands. I could have been carrying him. Not like I should have run after him,
right,
or he was so close, or why didn't you go faster, or something like that. It all came back to her and that random thing. It's like when you lose your car keys or you know, you get into a car accident or something like that, and you're thinking, oh, man, if I just braked harder at that stop, if I just, you know, thought before I set them down on the counter or the couch or wherever.
Right.
It's that little stuff, the things that are easily avoidable, that are nobody's fault, but you can take on that sense of guilt when something bad happens.
Right. And I guess you would have to, at some point, articulate what you feel guilty about. And they haven't had an opportunity, as we know, that we know of, to do that up until that point in the story, right?
Right.
So,
yeah. And I think what's great about what she says is there was no reason for her to carry that boy, because he was self-sufficient, he could walk, it's fine, they're all barefoot. But she went there.
Yeah.
Because she's grasping it. Was there anything I could have done? And she's all, like you said, she's always replaying that in her mind. You know, and it was even, maybe there's almost even a sense of guilt after delivering this baby. It's like, here I am bringing another baby into this world, and my thoughts just go back to the one I lost.
Yeah.
And I can't escape that. And you know, it's pretty powerful, you know. Yeah. And I even like, you know, the fact that I think that all of the family members, I'm going back to what I said, and all the family members have that post-traumatic stress from that scene on the bridge. You know, the daughter feels responsible. The little boy who survived is horrified mm-hmm. at the thought of going anywhere. You know, and that's why he's reluctant to learn how to protect himself out yeah. there. And I think that, that if you didn't have that scene in the beginning, then the rest of the movie just doesn't play out right.
Yeah.
You know, I really liked the way the movie thought through some details that I was questioning. How are they going to handle this? And then they would handle it. Or, gee, what about this? And then they would handle it. And one of those moments I really thought was great was when the baby's born and they find a way to silence the baby. I don't want to give away exactly what it is, but yeah. it was nothing I would have ever expected what they did over the face and in the, you know, you know what I'm talking about. I mean, it just is really a spectacular moment. And then I think I could hear people in the audience sort of gasp a little bit when they did sort of what they did.
Well, they put we're way past it.
Okay, right.
They put the, you're talking about where they put the lid on the
oxygen.
Yes, it's
and
like,
the,
a, like a putting it, it's putting it in a coffin. And so when David was mentioning a minute ago the guilt over the death of the baby, it's almost like it's playing out. They're putting the baby in a coffin and burying it. I mean, they really do bury it under the floor. So it's just kind of a provocative moment.
Yeah, totally.
Very much so. Like I didn't. So the oxygen. Maybe you guys can help me figure this out. The hose from the oxygen went under the lid into the mask.
Yes, because there was a cutout in the box.
Yeah. Okay, because I saw it when he placed the lid down. I thought I saw like a little hole, almost like an air hole. I'm like, because that's not going to cut it.
No.
But yeah, the oxygen thing is paid off because earlier we see her testing out the mask and she places it on like a teddy bear or something like that. And you know, there's all these details that a really smart movie that wants to freak people out, they're going to go where the audience is going to go instantly. Because everyone thinks they can survive a horror movie. You know, oh, I would have done this or I would have done that. They're ready for us.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I think right away, I mean, not right away, but gradually we see that, man, all of their planning, no matter what the dad does, no matter what the mom does, you can't anticipate what a teenager is going to do. And they're just going to thwart you at every turn. And I love the fact that, you know, he is trying to be patient with her. I mean, they pretty much use sign language within, you know, everybody uses sign language. The whole family uses sign language in this movie, particularly with her. And he really is trying to reason with her. He really is trying to just... But you're also exhausted as a parent because you're just trying to keep everybody alive.
Yeah.
And he's just like, don't go in there. No, we need you here. And she's just not having it because there's the hormones and there's the teenage thing and she's trying to be her own person. But she also feels a sense of guilt and responsibility for her brother dying. And she feels like she can never come up from under that. And I love the fact that it doesn't really ever hit us really, you know, heavy. It doesn't really hit us over the head with what's going on with the parent-teen drama, but you feel it because we've seen in so many movies the belligerent teen, who's really trying to push the parents' buttons. But here, you know that these buttons can kill you. You know,
They don't have the knockdown drag out like you'd ever loved
like,
me.
You don't let me go out with my boyfriend. It's like,
right?
Okay, honey, there's no boyfriend.
But they can't have those like over-dramatic conversations because of the situation they're in, so they're forced to experience these things in these honest moments. The resolution with her relationship with her father happens, you know, a minute before he dies, and they get to have that lovely...
That's a total Spielberg moment.
Right. This movie, how is it this movie is more Spielberg than the
Ready
movie
Player
that
One
came out last week?
Mm-hmm. Okay, well.
I also felt it was a little old school Stephen King. I felt at the beginning of the film, Cemetery, I'm sorry, Children of the Corn, at the beginning of the film was certainly there. I think we referenced The Mist earlier also. It really evokes that feel, doesn't it?
Corn all around him.
Yeah.
Silo.
Help me out with something, because this is something else I didn't quite pick up on. They do run into, the dad and the son, run into...
An old couple?
Old couple. The woman has died. Did he kill her? Was she mauled? I couldn't... She was bleeding.
I think she was mauled, and he was on the verge of giving himself up.
Yeah.
Okay, because that was when the PG-13-ness of the movie really hit me, is because I thought... The framing of the old man's face, I thought they're trying really hard not to show him with a gun just off screen or something like that, like he was going to blow his head off. But then he just yelled.
That was a great scene. It did remind me of last year's It Comes at Night when they run into that other those other couple that could be a threat to them.
Mm-hmm.
That's the thing is, part of me was thinking, okay, they're not that far from home. Did they never run across this house with that old couple? Or, you know, did they not prepare for the fact that, you know, humans can sometimes be more dangerous than monsters?
It's a dystopia. The rules don't apply.
But they should. You know, it's like you should be prepared as much as, you know, as you can, and not just for the monsters, but for the other desperate humans out there.
Yeah.
And, you know, what I liked about it is just that, you know, this is something that you would think somebody would do, is just totally just, they've had enough, they just want to die.
Yeah.
You know?
Let me ask you guys this. We see so much of the idea of a dystopian future society in sci-fi and horror films now. Is it played out at this point?
I was looking at your review of Ready Player One, and you asked this question about dystopian futures. Like, is there anything that's, like, I can't remember exactly how you phrased it, but, you know, everything is just, like, miserable, and, are there any happy, like, shining, you know, landscapes left?
It wouldn't be a horror film then if there were dystopias, maybe, I don't know, but I kind of long for the days of old school horror films where you could just line a bunch of people up and kill them. You know, you didn't have to have subtext about the world going to shit. You didn't have to be.
Slasher films?
Yeah, but they were just were innocently enjoyable because they were just about creating tension and, you know, very, very down to brass tacks. Mm-hmm. Now it has to be a much higher concept.
Yeah.
And dystopia is part of that, I think.
And but it gets back to what we were talking about a little bit earlier, the horror movies that no one feels comfortable calling horror movies, because that kind of evokes, oh, it's a slasher movie or it's a monster movie.
Yeah.
You know, what was it? It Follows, and you mentioned Babadook and all this other stuff. Yeah. You can't just say, oh, it's a great horror movie. It's like, oh, no, it's a psychological, supernatural thriller. I'm like, no, it's a horror movie.
Yeah.
But on the other hand, you also get, you know, Platinum Dunes, Michael Bay's company 10 years ago gave us Texas Chainsaw Remake and Nightmare on Elm Street Remake and Friday the 13th Remake. So I don't know if there's a balance of, like, recapturing that 80s slasher magic where it's not glossy, but it is, you know, kind of extreme fun.
If you're a horror film filmmaker, though, do you think you can just set about to make an old-school horror film now without having some sort of sophisticated, self-referential, meta concept of some sort?
Don't expect a theatrical release.
Yeah, I was going to say, like, it'll on the VOD. Indie scene, maybe, but, like, yeah. I don't know.
Maybe
everything's
call
very
it Saban Films.
No. Their last several movies have been horror films, but not intentionally.
Throw in Bruce Willis and you're all set.
I agree. I think it'd be nice to be able to go to a multiplex and see something like, I mean, I think about Rob Zombie's making a sequel to Devil's Rejects, which I'm all on board for, but I'm thinking, like, that was maybe not the last movie of its kind that I can think of, but it's the one that springs to mind the most. Like, that's a gritty, kind of a throwback road picture.
Barbarism,
that's very horrific, but it's not high concept. I don't necessarily want to see more of that kind of, like, uber nihilism, but I get what you're saying.
Yeah.
But then you have, like, this fall, we're going to have David Gordon Green doing a Halloween movie.
Yeah.
You know, and so what, you know, here's an indie guy, you know, who's done some genre stuff, but, like, he's going full out genre here, taking, you know, a movie that shouldn't have ever been turned into a franchise, but, you know, it's like, hopefully, you could watch the first one. And maybe you could watch this one.
It'll be the Rocky Balboa of the Halloween franchise.
Yeah, you could watch Rocky and Rocky Balboa and you'll be done. But maybe you could watch this and John Carpenter's original and then you'll be done.
I don't think we know what works right now, though.
Yeah.
We keep trying different types of horror films, and some hit like Get Out could be considered, what, a social thriller or something like that.
Sure.
But back in the day, you could make a slasher film and you would know that, you know, Halloween was made for $250,000 and it made, you know, $40 to $50 million at the box office, and the formula worked. And I don't think we have a formula for horror films anymore.
And then that started the formula of slasher films.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, if you look at, like, you know, Blumhouse, I mean, they've definitely got their kind of thing down. You've got the Insidious and the Conjuring and Paranormal Activity. Yeah, wasn't that one of their first?
Yes, Paranormal
hits?
Was.
Yeah.
Yes.
Okay. Yeah. That I was. It was so long ago that I was like, I don't even associate that with, like,
and they're
Blumhouse.
All interchangeable.
Yeah. But but that's not like you know, that's more the supernatural realm. That's not like the kind of the slasher thing we're talking about.
I suppose supernatural always sells, though. When you see a movie like you know, The Last Exorcism, or you see
religious supernatural.
Yes, I mean those things that get dumped into January, February every year. There's usually two or three of them, and they're profitable.
They
work, right?
Yeah.
I think the idea of killers is out, though. Slashers and killers has been out for quite a while.
That's something that's going to be kind of problematic, especially because in this age where we're still trying to figure out the, you know, how much can you push the objectification of, you know, nubile young naked women running around, even in the context of, I don't know what context you can
say that
make
like it's
that.
A bad thing again.
Look, no, here's the thing. I'm all for nubile young teenagers running around campsites, but I'm just saying it's a little trickier sell nowadays than
I'm
it might be.
I'm still wishing for a slasher film or a horror film set in a senior home. I want to see old men just going nuts and like, we're being, you know.
There was Bubba Hotep. There was also Cockneys versus Zombies. Right. Had a little bit of
Senior Home Invasion. Character piece.
True.
And that's what I like about going back to this movie is it feels, yes, there's a monster, it's creepy, but it feels more like, man, I hope this family makes it.
Yeah.
You know, and just... You know, you never feel like that. I want that annoying teenage daughter to die. You know, I never felt that. I just meant, you just really feel like, I hope this family makes it. And, you know, that's just kind of rare nowadays, you know. Yeah.
Very much so.
Be surprised if Emily Blunt rides this movie to a lot of talk this year about her career high performance for her, and I think there's going to be a lot of talk about the novelty of what she's done and how tricky it's been. It's extremely difficult to pull that off.
Ever since Edge of Tomorrow, man. I mean, holy cow, she was awesome in the Edge of Tomorrow.
Even probably before that, right?
I've liked her before that, but you know, she's signed on for some duds. Let's not forget Gulliver's Travel.
Look how
with
good
Jack
she
Black.
Is in duds. Like, she was great in Girl on the Train, which was a dud.
Yeah, that movie sucked, but she was great in it. Yeah.
Yeah. And that's kind of the thing I don't want to think about, not Girl on the Train, but this movie's awards prospects, because I'm thinking, yeah, definitely, why couldn't this have come out? This could have been like a late August release. It's April, so like you've got a long way to go till award season. I hope there's some kind of a push on the part of Paramount, maybe like some kind of a fall re-release or something like that, because this is definitely... I give a shit about this character and this actress doing this part.
Yeah.
It's no Get Out. It doesn't have the social ramifications or game-changing type, you know, elements to it as Get Out. But, you know, it's still coming from a director that we didn't think that could deliver something like this. And there's a lot of genuineness in this movie.
Yeah.
It's family values in the heartland. That's what it is.
There we go. This movie's going to make America great again. Sorry. On that note, any final thoughts on A Quiet Place?
You know what? We really have to talk for a minute about Millicent Simmons, who we all saw in Wonderstruck last year, Todd Haynes' film.
Right.
You know, the deaf young teen actress in the movie. And if you really think about the movie, we're talking a lot about Emily Blunt and about the family dynamics, but the hero of the movie, who sort of saves the day and holds her own at the end of the film in some tough scenes, is Millicent Simmons.
Yeah.
And she happens to be deaf also. And so the actual degree of difficulty in her performance in the carrying of those scenes, particularly the scene at the end where she's holding onto the hearing aids, I just think we shouldn't undersell how good she is and how she conveys that emotion with a different skill set than the other actors who are working in the movie.
You know, I did not see Wonderstruck, and I don't know about Millicent Simmons. I didn't know that she was a deaf actress.
Yeah.
Regardless, I mean, I don't know what I was about to say. I was like, she plays it really well. but
it's natural.
But it is. I mean, and it's not, you know, this doesn't feel like a deaf character. Like they're trying to say something, you know, about her deafness, or like it's this magical superpower that saves the day or something. I mean,
it's funny. I almost wish you didn't say that, but it makes sense. And I wish you didn't say that for the listeners. But I'm glad you kind of put things into perspective, because I didn't notice it really at all in Wonderstruck, but it is almost kind of like a silent film.
Yes.
You know, and of course this one kind of is too, but it's kind of, you know, that's just a testament to this film being kind of perfectly cast.
Yeah.
You know, and I'm wondering how much... Yeah, you always have casting directors in movies, but I'm wondering how much, like, maybe Krasinski was involved in casting the movie. It would be interesting to know. But, yeah, she was really good. And she's...
Really great.
As far as a character, she was a character with probably the most noticeable character arc.
Yeah.
One of my favorite scenes with her in it is when she's totally fed up. And normally, if sound was an issue in this world, she would be... throwing things off the wall, tearing things up, and she only, I think she just throws something onto the mattress and it doesn't make a sound, but you could tell she just wants to tear up her little section of the barn there, and she does it so well, and that's when she just sits down and silently cries, and you just feel it.
It's... Yeah, I think if you know that she's deaf, when you see the movie, the sound design around her character is really fascinating because, as you guys know, he drops the sound in and out when she's when it's from her perspective. And sometimes in a scene, you have that sort of like level, that bed of sound, and then we cut to her perspective, and it's gone, and then it's back, and then it's gone. And so when you're sort of thinking about her as an actress in the scene, you're realizing that's what she would have gone through an actress. And versus what the other actors did. And so it's just really complex and interesting.
Yeah, and it really is interesting because, okay, this creature sees with their hearing, and she basically hears with her eyesight. You know, it's really interesting, you know, because even when they're in that truck scene, she sees that, you know, what her father's doing, but she also sees what her brother is doing. He freaks out too, and she tries to protect him. So it's almost like, you know, this girl is making up for this lost sense that she has, and these creatures are making up for this lost sense that they have.
Yeah, and they sidestep this whole thing that you usually get in these movies, or in, say, the TV show Daredevil, where you're like, you get that, you've got the blind
sonar,
or the deaf creature, you get the sonar vision, or you're like an alien
Predator.
Covenant, and it's like, oh, look, it's warbly and slimy. And this, again, that's another great detail that this movie gets right. It gives us just enough without pushing into that cheese territory. It's like, oh, I've seen this 100 times.
And I mentioned it before, but I'm just so glad that the writers and the director just trust us.
Yeah.
You know, and we don't have to be, you know, fed all this information. We see all these newspaper clippings on the wall. We don't have to see talking heads of people or hear people over the radio, if you're listening to this, we found a weakness. It's like, ugh. You know, it's
there's
like,
no CNN news anchors, you know, giving us the report of what went down.
It's so great, you know. So, yeah, I mean, I think that, in a way, this is a kind of a much better Cloverfield movie than a lot of the latest Cloverfield movies.
In a great dystopian horror film.
Indeed.
For the whole family.